Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the outing of an FBI confidential informant who President Trump is claiming was a spy infiltrated into his campaign, which he's demanding the Congress investigate, tweeting out that, quote, "This is bigger than Watergate." Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us to discuss how Trump is trying to gin up a campaign of phony outrage to get Devin Nunes and the junkyard dogs of the so-called Freedom Caucus to yap loudly along with Sean Hannity and the Fox News propagandists in the hope Trump can use this as an excuse to slow or shut down the Mueller investigation. We'll assess whether the revelation that a 73-year-old American professor at Cambridge University, who has been a longtime CIA and FBI informant for the administrations of Republican presidents Reagan, Bush, and Bush Jr., and was meeting with Trump's campaign officials who the FBI suspected had ties to the Russians, will be seen by the broader public as the smoking gun Trump is trying to make it appear to be. We'll also examine the latest expose from the New York Times on meetings in Trump Tower and the Seychelles brokered by the convicted child molester George Nader, who set Donald Trump Jr. up with Eric Prince, who was offering his services to the Trump campaign to use his mercenary army in the Emirates to start a war with Iran. Then we'll go to Venezuela to get an update on today's elections, which are widely seen as a choice between participating in a rigged election or boycotting the vote, thus handing the incompetent ideologue Maduro another term as the country spirals into economic ruin and social disintegration. Caracas-based journalist Virginia Lopez, who covered Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian and Al Jazeera English, joins us to discuss her article at the Toronto Globe and Mail, "In Venezuela, an Election Where No One Wins," and how the oil infrastructure in the once oil-rich country is so neglected and mismanaged that oil exports will soon grind to a halt. Then finally, James and Deborah Fellows joins us in the studio to discuss their new book just out, "Our Towns, A 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America." James has been a national correspondent for The Atlantic for more than 35 years, and Deborah is a linguist and writer, and they have traveled into America's heartland in their small private plane to discover a surprising portrait of the civic and economic reinvention taking place outside of the view of the national media, which at a time of polarization and political dysfunction is both welcome and encouraging. And joining us now is Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Ian, great to be with you.
Well, thank you, Scott. And I recently interviewed the Yale historian Timothy Snyder, who's got a very important new book, "The Road to Unfreedom." And the portrait that he offers us is a very accurate one, and he's a very insightful person. And essentially, we are trapped between an autocrat and a wannabe autocrat. We're trapped between Putin and Trump. And that the only way that American democracy is going to be rescued is by Robert Mueller. And every day, that appears to me to be more and more the stark choices facing us. And a lot of liberals, I spoke to a bunch of progressives the other day, who are losing heart, who think that Trump is going to win. They think he's going up in the polls and that somehow the truth will never come out and this criminal will get away with it.
Well, I'll second you on Timothy Snyder's book. I think it's a fabulous and important book, The Road to Unfreedom, and particularly in the way he traces the ideological influences on Putin and the way these, particularly a couple of Russian thinkers who are not really well known, and the way they've influenced his rule in Russia and his dealing with the Western powers. That's right. And I think right now, of course, it's ridiculous to pin all hopes on one man, Robert Mueller, and think that that he'll cure everything. You know, our system doesn't work that way. And I think back to a great speech that Learned Hand gave in Central Park in New York about a week, 10 days before the D-Day invasions, in which he says, freedom lies in the hearts of men, and it will only be preserved when the citizenry generally realizes the importance of freedom and acts on it. So it's really a high level of a public understanding of what's happened and insistence that things work the way the Constitution and the Founding Fathers intended them to work that will turn things around. And that translates into votes at the ballot box, but much more than that.
Well, but at the moment, it appears that President Trump is both at war with the truth and at war with the law. And if he wins, then that's the beginning of the end of American democracy, and we'll become more and more like Russia.
That's right. I mean, he's sort of awkwardly at war with the apparatus of government that he, in fact, heads, which is strange. I think we've never seen anything quite like that in the past, but particularly the law enforcement mechanism. So, I mean, he behaves and has, since he was sworn in, behaved like someone who feels he's on the other side of the law and feels very, very vulnerable to law enforcement investigations. And I think when we look at all the scandals that are swirling around him, we understand why. Because I think a lot of the matters we're looking at now are things that happened after he became president. Many of them have nothing to do with the Russia scandal per se. They have to do with how he deals and how he interacts with foreign governments, which seems to consistently put his personal financial interests and the interests of his family up front.
But his basic point is that the law should be working for me, not working against me. And no, I mean, that's an absurd notion.
It's completely absurd. And, you know, you have the basic principle, you know, that Thomas Paine put down at the time of the American Revolution. Who is the king in America? And he said, the law is the king. So, you know, what is fundamental to, was fundamental to the American Revolution and to the founding principles of the country is this idea that all are beholden to the law and must act consistently with it. And that certainly includes the president. In fact, I think the understanding from the beginning was anyone who became president would have to agree to considerable restrictions on how they could behave. I mean, it results in a constriction of freedoms when you obtain high public office. That of the highest magistrate of the land, as George Washington called it.
Let's turn to the outing of the 73-year-old American professor at Cambridge University, who's been a long-time source for both the CIA and the FBI, and he was used as an informant by the FBI because they had I think they had four or five FISA warrants against Carter Page. They kept renewing them. Carter Page was hanging out with Russian spies who were trying to recruit them. The Russian spies were eventually arrested and kicked out of the country. I mean, the Republicans have been trying to suggest that somehow, you know, Carter Page's civil rights were violated. I mean, it's an absurd notion. So these guys, Papadopoulos and Carter Page, come up on the FBI's radar because of their interactions with the Russians. And so they asked this guy, who's a Republican, who served Republican presidents and may well have had a role in working against Jimmy Carter on behalf of Ronald Reagan, he is obviously the right guy to talk to them. So how can Trump make a case that this is an infiltration by a spy and worse than Watergate? Are we that stupid in this country that we're going to buy that?
Well, I think it's clearly a sign of desperation because they have very few substantive defenses to throw out here. And so they're grasping at whatever they can find. Now, in this case, you know, I think what happened is pretty much what you would expect would happen. And contrary to what you've heard from Devin Nunes and from Trump, the focus of this intervention was on two individuals, and the focus was outside of the United States. It was conduct by these two individuals abroad, and their interaction with people who were believed to be or actually even known to be intelligence agents of the Russian government. And a decision was made to just check in and see, did they understand what they would do, what they were doing and who they were dealing with, just pose a few basic questions and learn a bit more information. And this was done using an asset. And now I think in this case, the person they chose was, of course, was based in the UK, was at Cambridge University, was in London frequently, and was very well known as a Republican, as a very partisan figure Republican, I'd say a fairly strident Republican, and also was, I think, pretty well known to have connections with the U.S. intelligence services going back some time. Of course, I mean, it was even discussed at length and a major feature in the New York Times at one point. So I think this was an effort to feel them out. It wasn't appointing someone as a spy to be embedded inside of the Trump campaign. And the choice, the individual that they selected and they used, seems to me to be very logical. I mean, you know, logical because they wanted an asset who would not be viewed as hostile to these people who shared their political orientation, and they wanted someone who had strong familiarity with the intelligence scene inside the UK, as this person did. And I think they had very few people they could have used for this purpose, and the person that they selected was a pretty obvious choice.
And of course, he, along with Christopher Andrews at Cambridge, apparently were alarmed by General Flynn's behavior when he was at a conference there on security, where he was consorting with a young Russian FSB honey trap, a so-called researcher, who they were writing love letters to each other, dear Misha, etc. This guy who was outed by Glenn Greenwald of The Intercept apparently was so alarmed by that that he reported that to the FBI, that the National Security Advisor is you know, being compromised by a Russian honey trap.
Well, exactly right. And he wasn't the only person who reported that. I mean, it was observed by several individuals who passed that information on to U.S. and U.K., intelligence, and I think that that whole incident is, and the fact that Flynn, after returning back to the States, didn't report what he did and who he dealt with, which, you know, everyone's required to do when you have certain levels of intelligence clearance. I think that's one of the things that put his whole career into a tailspin and led to its conclusion.
Well, Trump sure knows how to pick them, I have to say. But just in the last couple of minutes, Scott, what did you make of the latest expose in the New York Times about a meeting that the convicted child molester, George Nader, set up in Trump Tower with Don Jr. and with Eric Prince of the Mercenary Army, which is, by the way, based in the Emirates. He's close to MBZ, who pretty much runs the Emirates. And they had also set up a back channel in the Seychelles, involving the Russians, but it looks as if what Eric Prince was pitching to Don Jr. was, I've got the ability to start a war against Iran.
I think that's exactly right. And you know, this is the fifth expose piece in a series, and the New York Times and a couple of other publications have secured an immense cache, thousands of pages of email communications involving these individuals, and they've got some of them cooperating to some extent. And of course, we know George Nader is now a cooperating witness with Mueller in the Mueller probe. So I think all of this shows that it's not just the Russians who were seeking to intervene and influence the election. It's also the Saudis and the Emiratis. And I think what we see really also from the Elliot Broidy and George Nader connections is that the Russian, Saudi, and Emirati efforts to support Trump were interwoven. So some of these same individuals are involved with all three. I mean, for instance, I'll tell you, George Nader. I've now seen three photographs of George Nader taken in different years of him standing one by one next to Vladimir Putin. So he was constantly in Russia. And as you mentioned, this meeting that was set up with Eric Prince and the Seychelles involved Kirill Dmitriev, who the head of the Russian Investment Fund, and the Russian Investment Fund itself involved an awful lot of Emirati money. So these things are all intermingled.
Well, it is an amazing story, and if you say that the New York Times has got volumes of emails of all these players, then the assumption would be that Robert Mueller has even more, and that would lead me to suggest that little wonder Trump is trying to shut down Robert Mueller.
I think that's right, and I think certainly all the disclosures surrounding Elliot Broidy and George Nader figure right at the center of the current probe, and it really is a focus on follow the money. Now, let's remember Elliot Broidy, you know, had a couple of $100 million from the Emirates, and he was at the same time the deputy chair of the RNC Finance Committee. He was a leading fundraiser and gatherer for the Republican Party throughout this period. So they're obviously very suspicious that he was used as a conduit to bring Russian, Emirati, Saudi money into the Republican coffers.
So just in closing then, Scott Horton, do you think this is going to work for Trump to try and make this the smoking gun? He's just obviously looking for an excuse, and he's got the Fox Echo Chamber, he's got Nunes, he's got the Freedom Caucus. They're all going to beat the drum on this. I'm just astounded that anybody would take him seriously, but apparently, you know, at least 30 to 40% of the public do. And then Trump has succeeded in making this whole Russia inquiry a partisan issue, which is why so many people dismiss it.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's much like the furor they tried to make earlier about eavesdropping on Trump and Trump Tower, which really fizzled out and went nowhere. And in fact, you know, yesterday afternoon, I was chatting with two broadcast executives of a major German news service who told me they were going back and forth, you know, should we report this story or not? I mean, you know, it's getting such reverberations on Fox and in the Rupert Murdoch empire right now, but the story is so incredibly stupid. Most people look at it and say, like, why are you wasting our time with this? It's nonsense.
Well, Scott, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Great pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the elections today in Venezuela, where the choice is voting in a rigged election or boycotting the election.
Beware of pretty faces that you find. A pretty face can hide an evil mind. Oh, be careful what you say, or you'll give yourself away. Odds are you won't live to see tomorrow. Secret Asian man, secret Asian.
Porque está viejo y cansado. Pero no se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas, es caballo desbocado. Y si una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a faceta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Venezuela is Virginia Lopez, a Caracas-based journalist who covered Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian and Al Jazeera English. She has an article at the Toronto Globe and Mail, In Venezuela, an Election Where No One Wins. Welcome to Background Briefing, Virginia Lopez.
Thanks, Ian.
And today, in Sunday in Venezuela, there is an election where there is a dreadful choice. The opposition, and I take it the majority of the people are against this government because it's destroyed the country and wrecked the economy. But the choice is between boycotting the election or participating in a rigged election. Is that the situation in simple terms?
Yes, absolutely. But like you said, you know, there's a huge desire for change. Most polls show that close to 80 people would like to see a change. But unfortunately, you know, the international community has deemed these elections to be fraudulent, and also the opposition has called for a boycott because along those same lines, they consider this vote to be a sham. So voter turnout is expected to be quite low. And yes, this is definitely an opportunity that could have, you know, brought about change. But given all the tricks and this international condemnation, it's probably going to result in Maduro winning power again.
So does anybody understand what's in Maduro's head? Why would you want to win power and continue the downward spiral of destroying this country? Is he totally in a state of delusion? Does he not know what's happening to the country?
Well, it's difficult to know what's going through his mind, but I suspect that one of the main motivations to remain in power is the fear of sanctions or the fear of political persecution, political retaliation, if an opposition government were to win power. I think in that way is not dissimilar to what happened in Zimbabwe when Tsvangirai won elections but was unable to assume power. You know, there's a lot of pressure from the military. There's been a lot of highly credible threats from the international community. Maduro has been sanctioned, and a lot of the people surrounding him have also been sanctioned. So, you know, again, I think this is become almost a matter of survival.
Right, but the threats from Donald Trump to invade backfired, did they not?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's more than the threat of an invasion, because that would be incredibly unpopular and unacceptable in the region, and also would probably lead to much worse things, as is usually the case. It's not so much, I think, what they fear. I think that what they're afraid of is just not being able to live comfortably if they were not in power. You know, certainly in Venezuela, it would be very uncomfortable for them to stay here with people just loathing them as they do, and leaving the country when they've got so many sanctions against them is certainly also, you know, an inconvenience. It's already been the case that a lot of former Chavistas who had exiled in Spain, they have been jailed in Spain and deported to the U.S. for trial. So again, you know, I think this is an elite that is feeling like they could soon be circled in or under siege.
But are the military also in league with the kleptocrats, these corrupt officials that you write about in your article at the Toronto Globe and Mail in Venezuela, an election where no one wins? You talk about these corrupt officials who, under the guise of socialism of the 21st century, have amassed huge fortunes. So is that kind of like a Russia situation there, where the entire country's impoverished, but you've got a handful of billionaires?
It's quite similar, yes. And as you know, Russia is also very involved in the oil industry here and stands to benefit probably from an opening of the industry, of the oil industry, which, as you know, is in shambles at the moment and in dire need of foreign aid or just changing. I'm not sure what form that would take.
So is it possible then that Russia and China can save Maduro? Will they step in? I mean, my understanding is that Venezuela owes China an awful lot of money, and they haven't seen anything being repaid. And you mentioned a minute ago, the Russians are starting to invest in the state oil company, but it is in a shambles from lack of investment. So what's your reading on that, Virginia? Do you think that that Russia and China will get involved for strategic and geopolitical reasons as opposed to economic ones, because the economic ones don't seem too promising?
Well, I think that the Russian and Chinese investment in the country is now completely at stake because of an event that happened at the beginning of May, which I don't know if it's gotten that much media attention in the U.S. and And what I'm referring to is ConocoPhillips seizing several of PDVSA, the state-run oil company. A lot of their assets in the Dutch Antilles in the Caribbean. The reason why ConocoPhillips did this is because they've won an arbitration decision after Chavez expropriated ConocoPhillips in 2007. The timing couldn't be worse for Venezuela, because this means should tankers try to leave Venezuelan waters, ConocoPhillips could also proceed to seize these. Of course, this snowballs with severe implications for the oil industry in the country. Venezuela is now no longer to refine its own oil and thus sell it. It's also probably going to soon have no storage space for the crude that it's pumping from underground. This, like I said, just spirals into an increasingly dire scenario. If you can't store crude, you're going to have to stop pumping it. And the moment you stop pumping oil is the moment where you kill the wells. So, again, we could easily be talking about a collapse within the next 4 or 5 weeks. But again, these elections seem to have overshadowed this, despite the fact that, the oil industry is Venezuela's lifeblood. And if we're not producing oil, if we're not selling oil, lights are going to start turning off, sadly.
So just to clarify, you're saying that the whole infrastructure is grinding to a halt, and that they're trying to get rid of or nationalize ConocoPhillips? Is that what you said?
No, I'm sorry. In 2007, Chavez nationalized ConocoPhillips.
Right.
ConocoPhillips has just won an arbitration, and the court said that Venezuela owes them $2 billion.
But oh,
Venezuela
I see.
Does not have $2 billion to take ConocoPhillips. So this court has allowed the American oil company to seize assets. And the beginning of May, they moved into... To seize these infrastructure facilities in the Dutch Antilles.
Right.
So Venezuela, is increasingly losing its ability to refine crude. The tankers that are loaded with crude have not been able to leave Venezuelan shores for fear of being also seized by ConocoPhillips.
And is Citgo here in the United States, their retail outlet of the National Venezuelan Oil Company, are they seizing Citgo stations here in the United States, or are they able to?
No, Citgo seems to have been spared, and this is a move that's affecting mainly the storage facilities and the refining facilities in Curaçao, Bonaire, Aruba, and St. Eustatius. It's also going to have, pretty dire implications for the Caribbean, because Venezuela used to provide several of these Caribbean nations with oil. It's, like I said, it could potentially be huge and far more important in defining the future of the country than today's elections.
And my understanding is that Venezuela has been subsidizing Cuba when the Soviets collapsed and the Russians left. The Venezuelans essentially rescued Cuba, which was in a state of collapse, by free oil and massive subsidies. My understanding is that Cuba is now receiving less and less oil. Is that right? Is that because of this condition you're talking about?
Yes. Overall, the whole of the Caribbean has been receiving less oil from Venezuela. This was a program that Chavez started. It was basically, what experts have called petrodiplomacy, or in other words, cheap oil in exchange for political support. And in the case of Cuba, allegedly medical and educational support. Although, like you said, the suspicion is that there was also an exchange of intelligence services here of Cubans infiltrating Venezuelan military and other intelligence bodies. But yes, all this has been falling apart and stands to come to a halt if Venezuela cannot recover its oil industry. And like I said, that day seems to be fast approaching.
So a Russian investment will be too little too late, you think?
It sounds that way, yes. Or just basically not worthwhile. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's extracting oil from Minnesota is becoming increasingly more difficult because of security reasons, because the infrastructure is in such a state of disarray. Even oil workers who used to be, you know, one of the most committed workforces here feel that, you know, that their meager salary isn't worth the trouble. So you're having a mass exodus of oil workers. It's just, it's a juxtaposed crisis after crisis. It's, you know, I don't know where to begin or if this is a problem that you can describe or explain because of just one cause. It's,
sure.
Like I said, it's a crisis at all levels.
Right, and the financial crisis and the inability to buy food, and you've got inflation that was 40% 5 years ago, and now it's at 13,000%. And Venezuelans are fleeing the country in droves. Millions have moved into Colombia and Brazil to a very uncertain future. It is an all-around tragedy, and it's just amazing that people don't understand this wrecking crew that's been in power for this long. And, you know, they've captured the press. They've taken over the Supreme Court. They neutralized the parliament. They lost their majority in the parliament, and then they turn around and use the courts to neutralize them. They do every trick in the book to stay into power, but the longer they stay in the power, the more they wreck the country. And the only way they're getting any votes today is to bribe voters with food. So it just, from the outside, it's like a absurd tragedy, but from your point of view as a Venezuelan, it's got to be heartbreaking.
Absolutely, especially because it's unnecessary and it's completely man-made and could have been avoided. You know, Venezuela used to be the most prosperous nation in the region. It was the longest-standing democracy in South America. And all that, you know, has been lost in 40 years and certainly, you know, even worsened in the past 17 years since Chavismo rose to power. So yes, it's an incredible tragedy and certainly a lost opportunity. I think Chavez could have changed the region for good. He had, you know, an incredible amount of power. He had an incredible amount of popular support, and he had incredibly high oil prices. You know, his power was not only within Venezuela. It was, like I said, it was regional. But he wasted that opportunity. You know, any of the social gains that you could have credited him with have been lost in less than 10 years. So, again, you know, I don't think that in the long run you can say that his project is worth repeating, certainly. It's horrible.
Well, Virginia Lopez, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's in Venezuela. She's a Caracas-based journalist who's covered Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian and Al Jazeera English, and she has an article at the Toronto Globe and Mail, "In Venezuela, an Election Where No One Wins." We're going to take a brief station break and be talking with James and Deborah Fellows joining us in the studio. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now in the studio is James and Deborah Fellows. James Fellows has been a national correspondent for The Atlantic for more than 35 years, reporting from China, Japan, Southeast Asia, Europe, and across the United States. He's the author of 12 books, and for 2 years, he was President Jimmy Carter's chief speechwriter. And Deborah Fellows is a linguist and writer who has worked at the Pew Research Center, Oxygen Media, and has taught at Georgetown University. And she is the author of Dreaming in Chinese, Mandarin Lessons in Life, Love, and Language. And together they have co-authored a new book just out, Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. Welcome to Background Briefing, James and Deborah Fellows.
Thank you, Ian.
So tell us about your mode of transportation first, because I see the picture of you with beside this single-engine prop plane. What is it? I used to fly out of Santa Paula with the old newsman, Cleet Roberts.
I remember Cleet Roberts.
You remember Cleet?
Of course.
Yeah.
I was a kid in Southern California.
Yeah, we did a lot of films and documentaries and news broadcasts together. He was sort of a mentor of mine.
Well, our plane is a kind that didn't exist in the era of Cleet Roberts. It's called the Cirrus SR-22. It's made in Duluth, Minnesota. It's famous around the world and the most popular small plane in the world, single-engine plane, because it has a parachute for the entire plane. So in time of duress, you pull a little red handle on the ceiling of the cockpit and you drift to the ground like a balsa wood airplane. And everybody who's done this in the past 20 years has walked away.
Right. But you're not speaking as one who's already experienced that.
No, it is something you do if the alternative is plummeting to the ground. So we haven't done that. We've had Cirruses for almost 20 years now, and we have enjoyed this means of going to little places around the country you wouldn't otherwise easily get to.
Right, and these are little rural airports?
Yeah, there are 5,000 airports across the country. Basically, every place is within 10 or 15 miles of an airport. So places like Rock Springs, Wyoming, or Red Oak, Iowa, or Ajo, Arizona, or all these other places, you can get to in a tiny plane and it's harder to do otherwise.
So obviously, there have been comparisons made to de Tocqueville. He, of course, being a French aristocrat, neither of you seem to fit that bill. But the idea of going into the heartland of America and finding and doing a reality check, right? I mean, we all, of course, we're on the blue coast and the other blue coast on the other side, and everything in between is red. And there's a sense of, of course, the famous New Yorker cartoon of the New Yorker
Steinberg,
and
yeah.
Right. So what propelled you both, Deborah? Why did you decide to take so much time off and travel around this great land of ours?
Well, there are a couple reasons behind it. We had been in China for several years before we started this adventure, and our MO in China and before that in Japan had been to go around to as many small towns and out-of-the-way places in those countries as we could, just be on the ground and get a real sense of the pulse of what was going on outside the major cities of Beijing and Shanghai. So when we came back to the U.S., it was the time when the country seemed like it was in a dark mood, and things on the national level seemed quite negative. Our impressions, as we had flown around the country to some small towns, that there was room for a different kind of narrative going on. That there was a lot going on in these small places around the country. So we wanted to get our instincts back of the whole rest of the country to see what we felt was going on when we would travel around from city to city. And we're from small towns ourselves. Jim, as he said, is from Redlands, which is inland in Southern California. I'm from a small town in Northern Ohio in the Rust Belt, right on Lake Erie. So, you know, we grew up happily and wanted to go to places that would resonate with us from our experience growing up and see what was happening in the country besides the national narrative.
So what did you find in terms of the red-blue divide, Jim? Because I was just watching the other day President Trump in Indiana before an adoring crowd, and you feel like you're in an alternative universe. You watch Fox News, you think that the deep state is out to get Donald Trump, and then if you watch MSNBC, you think that at any moment Trump's going to be dragged out of the White House either in a straitjacket or an orange jumpsuit. So welcome to today's polarized America.
So there would be two images I would sort of contrast to what we've found. One was the famous New Yorker cartoon of 30 or 40 years ago you mentioned by Saul Steinberg, saying, you know, there's 7th Avenue and there's 3rd Avenue and then there's a kind of this wasteland. You have L.A. on the other side. What really impressed us was how three-dimensional and dense and active and lively and experimenting in things to make their communities better, places in Nebraska and South Dakota and South Carolina and Mississippi and other places were. So that's essentially the chronicle we have. The other thing about the divide is that if you should be so rash as to do what we never did, asking people, hey, what do you think about Obama? Where was he born? Or what about Trump? You know, what about the Russians? Then it would be just like turning on cable news. You would hear just the things you hear on cable news. If you didn't ask people that, you would find in cities that are theoretically the opposite, like Greenville, South Carolina, and Burlington, Vermont. We sort of pair as cities. One is very conservative, Greenville. One is very progressive, Burlington. But they work the same way. The city government works with the universities, works with the companies, works with the state government, and they have very similar schools and civic activities and all that. So our message is that a time of really polarized national politics, the texture of the country actually is not that way, and people are still practical-minded and willing to do reasonable things.
But there is a kind of political paradox, and it's built into the Constitution and the political DNA with the Electoral College. The trend now is such that red state, the middle of the country, is being depopulated. People are moving to the cities, particularly in the blue states. And as populations get concentrated in the blue states, they in effect lose political clout under our system because Wyoming has two Republican senators and has 700,000 people. California has 38 million and has two Democratic senators. So is the sense of the stripping of middle America happening? Are there shuttered streets? Is that something that you came across?
No, we certainly didn't come across that. I mean, there were towns that we went to, Hazleton, Pennsylvania, for example, that were in a pretty grim state. Although I'll say that in the few years we've been to Hazleton, Pennsylvania, the mayor has written to us and said, after reading our book, come to my town and see how we've changed as well. So we've seen a tremendous amount of engagement and activity in towns that are doing a whole bunch of things, redoing their downtowns into main streets that are vibrant and accessible to people, with new shops, small shops opening up and new accommodations above them. We've seen school systems that are building in programs that are meaningful to the locale. For example, Winters, California, which is up in the top of the Central Valley in an agricultural town. Half the kids in that high school are taking ag classes, not only the history and economics of California, but how to use and maintain the agricultural equipment, and they're growing nut trees out in the back of their school, making education both relevant to these kids in the area which they live, and giving them a new kind of sense and a modern sense of where they can go in employment with their lives as a way to keep them in the towns in and help build the industries that are already there or start new ones.
Right, but isn't that a part of California that wants to secede?
Yes, and if they did, they'd be the poorest state of, you know, the poorer than Mississippi. Right. So Deb and I, one reason we get along so well is we have different ways of approaching things, and Deb tends to say things in absolute terms. And I'm saying, yes, there are a lot of very small towns that have suffered, but more places than not, we saw some kind of rejuvenation. Also, as the oldest person within listening range of this studio, I can say that I've been around long enough to see political trends that seem to be unchangeable and inevitable that change. You know, when I was a little kid, the South was a Democratic solid South. And in the 70s, California was going to be the bulwark of the Republican Party forever. And things change. And we were in Laramie and Cheyenne, Wyoming, which are, you know, all cities in the country, even in Wyoming, are Democratic. And so as cities in Wyoming and Kentucky and South Dakota populate relatively, so those states become more liberal.
Right, but it doesn't necessarily translate to the Senate, which is the point I was trying to make.
But if they carry the state, they do. So as the population of Wyoming become – Wyoming will be the last one. but Georgia is going to change.
Right. And again, I'm joined in the studio by James Deborah Fellows. Together they have co-authored a new book just out, Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. So just to touch on some of the news of the moment, the Secretary of State, a former Secretary of State who was fired, Rex Tillerson, spoke at the VMI, the Virginia Military Academy, and he said, and it's pretty clear that who he's referring to here, if our leaders seek to conceal the truth, or we as people become accepting of alternative realities that are no longer grounded in facts, then we as American citizens are on a pathway to relinquish our freedom. So back to the siloing between the universe of Fox and the universe of MSNBC. You were pretty much, I imagine, in the universe of Fox traveling through the country. Are they concerned about this issue of so much that the liberals in this country and the urban people are concerned about with Trump? But what about the issues that this former head of Exxon, who's hardly a liberal, brought up?
So as you and I spoke more than 20 years ago when I had a book coming out called Breaking the News, How the Media Undermine American Democracy. And I was worried then when Fox News was only a couple months old about how there was going to be this sort of hiving off in separate realms of separate realities. And obviously we've seen sort of the nightmare version of that. Again, when it comes to impressions of national news and the world outside one's borders, what is striking to me is that people are still reasonable-minded about things within their personal experience. There's a poll just in the last month or so by Pew saying that while even only like 25% of the public thinks the country is okay, something like 75 or 80% of the public thinks their own communities are okay. And so I think we're in the middle of an actual civic engagement struggle where the sanity that still prevails at a local level is in contention with the polarization and insanity at the national level. And so it's up to all of us to win that struggle.
And in terms of our divided country, Deborah, I mean, there's always been extremes, though, hasn't there, in America? I mean, between piety and porn, you've got Pence on one side and Stormy Daniels on the other. It doesn't seem that we do things in sort of, what should I say, the gray area is not that real.
Talk about dealing with your parents on these issues.
Well, you know, what I'd like to talk about actually is the sensibility that we felt when we were in the small towns, which didn't feel like it was ripping apart or that there was a lot of anger or contention. It felt more like people were recognizing what was going on at a national level, but felt that where they were going to act and have an impact was on their local level, and that if they had in towns like Greenville, South Carolina, that was majority conservative, but still had a lot of liberal people, they would get along and act in a cooperative way for the betterment of that particular town, rather than also divide themselves the way they saw nationally the country being divided.
Right. But the assumption is that most Americans are in the middle politically. Is that gone because of the gerrymandering, Fox? There's all kinds of reasons. How do you read that from your experiences across this country where you met with hundreds of civic leaders, workers, immigrants, educators, environmentalists, artists, public servants, librarians, business people, city planners, students, and entrepreneurs, and you were taking the pulse of this country?
Again, I'll give a concrete example, the town of Greenville that Deb is discussing, where, again, it's where Trey Gowdy is from, and before him, Jim DeMint, and it's the home of Bob Jones University, and people there all vote one way nationally. But the way they run the city, the conservative leadership is working with the public schools in the poorest and most diverse neighborhoods in Greenville to bring in, you know, teachers from GE and Michelin factories to have this place called the Elementary School of Engineering in Greenville. And so I think that we have these contradictory realities. In national politics, as you say, the middle ground is not there anymore. It's a contest of who you hate more. But in people's – the other 98% of their lives, people are not that way. And so the question is why this – if you ask people about national politics, they are so bitter, how we can have the 98% of American life reform that 2%.
And Deborah, is it a case of – and this is pretty prevalent amongst Trump supporters – is that they just feel that they've been abandoned and overlooked by Washington. Of course, Washington's become the whipping boy for politicians for several decades now. But is there a sense of alienation from the country? Or, I mean, how do you explain the heart and soul of the heartland, the patriotism at the same time, a sense of alienation, if indeed that is what it is?
You know, alienation is a powerful word, and I don't think it wasn't our sense that people went around day by day feeling alienated. They weren't happy, perhaps, with what was going on, but it wasn't something that was a heavy load on their shoulders of how they should live their daily lives. Mm-hmm. And so when I think you could say it was more a dismissal, that people weren't waiting around for something to change in Washington or to make their lives better, but rather that they would go on and do what they could do and had an impact in their own town. And it felt more like that in times of election, like this past election, that there were a lot of people who were voting traditionally the way that they had always voted, not necessarily that they were tremendously enthusiastic about the Republican side of the ticket. They certainly weren't going to vote for the Democratic side because they never did, the Democrat side. But it felt more like a default vote than it was a huge eruption of anger pouring out from people.
So, but all of the things that I'm afflicted to have to cover on a daily basis, the daily dose of doom, the constant sort of antics in the White House, which you arguably often are the politics of distraction. But nevertheless, we're constantly whipsawed by what's going on in Washington and what obsesses the media. My sense is that none of that breaks through in the areas that you traveled in, that they don't know much or care much about Robert Mueller, Stormy Daniels, Michael Cohen, you name it.
I think that is so. And if you ask them, many people in the places that we went would have a sort of Fox News prepared answer. Oh, Mueller is just on a witch hunt. Oh, it's been a year. He hasn't come up with anything. But if you didn't ask them, the sort of narrative of daily life would not include this. And I could give you 100 examples, but I'll just give you one. We were in Dodge City, Kansas. Kansas, very conservative state. Western Kansas, very conservative part of the state. Dodge City is now majority Latino because of the beef packing industry. So it has a very conservative Anglo political establishment and a majority Latino population. Sounds like tinderbox. Sounds like powder keg. In fact, the citizens of Dodge City have voted themselves an increased tax to pay for their mainly Latino public schools to offset the Sam Brownback cutbacks at the state level. Their city finance director is a guy named Ernesto de la Rosa, who is here on a DACA waiver, and they're all trying to protect him after voting for Trump. We talked to a very right-wing entrepreneur there who runs a company called Servitech, and he said he really liked the fact that his son in the Dodge City Public Schools was the only one in his family who could sing Feliz Navidad with all the verses in Spanish. And so if you ask them, what about Mueller, they'll say witch hunt. If you ask them, what about Dodge City, they'll say, well, we need Ernesto de la Rosa. We need to keep our schools working.
Well, in terms of the heart of the heartland in these small towns, is there a kind of meeting place? Is there a town hall as they used to be in the old traditional America? My sense is that now you have sort of mega churches and maybe the odd mall, but is there still a sense of local community, of places where people meet, not necessarily to talk politics, but just to talk about civic engagement?
The answer to this may surprise you, and it surprised us at once. It's the public libraries in town. The public libraries have become the institution that is not only a social gathering place, but it's a place that fills in the gaps that have been created, gaps in education. They're very prolific in having all kinds of preschool programs for kids before they go to kindergarten. It's a huge mission for libraries. They fill in the gaps in technology. 25% of homes around the country do not have fast Wi-Fi connection, but if you walk into a library, first thing you see are banks of computers where people are either learning the basics and how to use search engines, or they're in bigger towns, they might be young entrepreneurs who don't have other place to start their businesses, so they'll spend their day in the library with the free Wi-Fi using it as an office. There are also great civic centers. You've got citizenship classes, ESL classes, fire prevention classes. You've also got tango lessons. In our D.C. Public Library, 4 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, if you walk into the main reading room, 80 people will be doing the tango. You can do yoga there. In the Brooklyn Public Library, you can do yoga while someone reads poetry off to the side to kind of get you in the Zen mood. The libraries have really become a heart and soul place in towns across America, big towns and little towns.
And, Jim, just in the last few minutes, since we both had lunch in the neighborhood where there's nothing new for me, obviously, I'm sick to death of all the local food. What's the sense of people getting in farmers' markets, local food? Is that movement spreading across the middle of the country?
That's a big deal. And in places you would not think of as Brooklyn-like or Hollywood-like or Berkeley-like, every place we went in western Michigan, where it's a very conservative area, in the hometown of Betsy DeVos, we saw all these local farmers' markets. I think almost every place we went, the sense of local food, local breweries, local distilleries, local coffee, local consciousness was a very palpable thing. To be clear, we're aware of every big problem the U.S. has right now, starting with opioids and dislocation. And the news we have to convey is most people feel as if they're moving in a positive rather than negative direction, including this local effort.
So, Deborah, just in concluding here, what is your takeaway message for urban America and our listeners, both locally and across the country, who tend to be somewhat to the left and liberal, and they're certainly urban by and large?
I would say that our takeaway message is, if you're skeptical of what we're saying, take the next year and go out and visit 3 or 4 towns around the country that you've never been to before. Hang out for a while and talk to people about what's going on and see if you find the same kind of social fabric, creativity, entrepreneurial spirit, bravery that are the traits of Americans that founded this country, that they're still there and operating in a very positive way. And I bet when you come back after a year, you will agree with us.
Just a quick follow-up, Jim. We're not talking about anger and division. Those words haven't come up in your conversation. Are people welcoming in these places?
If you didn't know any of the national polarization about immigration, you would think the process of assimilation is going on pretty much the way it has through our history, which is to say never smoothly, never trouble-free, but it proceeds. So I think that if you ask about national politics, you'll hear anger. If you don't, you'll hear a very different, more confident tone.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with James Fellows, who's been a national correspondent for The Atlantic for more than 35 years, reporting from China, Japan, Southeast Asia, Europe, and across the United States. He's the author of 12 books, and for 2 years he was President Jimmy Carter's chief speechwriter. And Deborah Fellows is a linguist and writer who has worked at the Pew Research Center, Oxygen Media, and taught at Georgetown University. And she's the author of Dreaming in Chinese, Mandarin Lessons in Life, Love, and Language. And together they have co-authored a new book just out, Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Kathleen Ash. And I'd like to welcome our new intern, Alejandra Lariva-Latt. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.